Good morning. My name is Stephanie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Pason Systems Third Quarter Results Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to avoid any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. The contents of today's call are protected by copyright and may not be reproduced without the prior written consent of Pason Systems Inc. Please note the advisories located at the end of the press release issued by Pason Systems yesterday, which describe forward-looking information. Certain information about the company that is discussed on today's call may constitute forward-looking information. Additional information about Pason Systems, including the risk factors relevant to the company, can be found in its annual information form. Thank you. Marcel Kessler, you may begin your conference.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Pason's Third Quarter 2016 conference call. With me here in Houston is John Faber, our Chief Financial Officer. I will start with a high-level overview of third quarter performance and our outlook. John will then dive into the details of our financial and operational performance, and we will then take any questions. As you know, the environment for oil field services remained very challenging worldwide during the third quarter. U.S. drilling activity, as measured in industry days, dropped 39% from the previous year period and declined 53% for the first 9 months of 2016. Canadian drilling activity experienced a similar 38% year-over-year reduction for the quarter and a 45% reduction for the first 9 months of the year. Most international markets continue to be similarly negatively affected. Based on third quarter results, directly reflect these declines in drilling activity. Revenue for the quarter was $39 million, a 44% decline from the previous year. Adjusted EBITDA was $8.5 million compared to $25 million in the previous year period, and free cash flow was positive at $3.4 million. The company incurred a net loss for the quarter of $7 million or 8 cents per share. Significant previously implemented cost reductions and lower depreciation expenses partially offset the revenue decline. U.S. and Canadian EDR market share was largely unchanged from the previous quarter. Revenue per EDR day in the United States was up 4% for the third quarter compared to the previous year, driven by higher adoption of certain products. In Canada, revenue per EDR day was down 8% year over year, resulting from price concessions and lower adoption of certain peripheral products. At the end of September, our cash position stood at $155 million and working capital at $192 million. There is no debt on our balance sheet, and we are maintaining our quarterly dividend at 17 cents per share. In the United States, drilling activity has followed a rebound in oil prices from February's low of $26 a barrel to about $45 today. The Baker Hughes active rig count in the U.S. climbed above 550 for the first time since February, up from a low of about 400 in May. However, the number of active rigs is still down by more than 200 over the same period in 2015, and of course a lot more than that in 2014. Almost half of the active rigs are operating in Texas, and most of the recent growth came in the Permian Basin. It is very likely that the second quarter of 2016 was the low point for North American drilling, both seasonally and cyclically, and that we are now in an environment of gradually improving drilling activity. However, oil prices continue to be volatile, and the outlook does remain uncertain. We do not expect significant increase in oil company capital spending plans in the near term. We also don't expect any improvements in pricing for some time. We believe that many producers will be reluctant to significantly dial up spending levels, even as crude markets show tentative signs of recovery. For the remainder of 2016, we aim to strike the optimal balance between cost control and investment in future growth. Our objective continues to be to generate positive free cash flow for the year before dividends. In Canada, we are experiencing increased competitive and pricing pressures. We are fully committed to holding on to our position as the service provider of choice for our key operator and drilling contractor customers. We are continuing to invest in future growth, including investing in new product development, in our service capabilities, in our infrastructure and systems, and in our international footprint. We plan to continue to allocate significant resources for R&D and IT, and we intend to spend up to $20 million in CapEx in 2016. We are focusing our product development efforts on our on-bottom and off-bottom product roadmaps. We are building on our strong market position and reputation and seek opportunities where we can take advantage of Pason's significant strengths. We believe that Pason continues to be very well positioned to maximize returns in the industry's upturn. I'm now turning the call over to John Faber for a more detailed look at the financials.
Thank you, Marcel. Consolidated third quarter revenue of $38.6 million was down 44% year over year from $68.5 million in the third quarter of 2015. And up 42% sequentially from the second quarter of 2016. Significant declines in drilling activity in each of our major operating regions was the primary driver of the year-over-year revenue decrease, while the sequential increase was attributable to both normal seasonality effect and a gradual recovery in industry conditions through the quarter. Adjusted EBITDA of $8.5 million for the quarter was down $16.3 million from adjusted EBITDA of $24.7 million in the third quarter of 2015, and up $10 million sequentially from negative $1.5 million in the second quarter of the year. Depreciation and amortization expense in the third quarter of $14.9 million compared to $19.3 million in the third quarter of 2015, and $13.6 million in the second quarter of 2016. The company recorded a net loss of $7.1 million for the third quarter of 2016, compared to a net loss of $18.6 million in the third quarter of 2015. As a reminder, third quarter 2015 results were significantly impacted by a $26.6 million impairment charge related to excess quantities of rental assets. On a per-share basis, the net loss equated to 8 cents per share compared to a net loss of 22 cents per share in the third quarter of 2015 and a net loss of 13 cents per share in the second quarter of 2016. For the first 9 months of 2016, consolidated revenue totaled $111.6 million, a 50% year-over-year reduction from $225.3 million in the first 9 months of 2015. Significant reductions in drilling activity in each of our major operating regions was the primary driver of the revenue declines. Adjusted EBITDA of $15.8 million for the nine-month period was down $60.6 million from $76.3 million in 2015. Depreciation and amortization expense for the nine-month period of $44.9 million was down 27% from $61.6 million in the first 9 months of 2015, due to reduced carrying value of rental assets as a result of impairment charges taken in the fourth quarter of 2014 and third quarter of 2015, as well as a significant reduction in capital expenditures in both 2015 and 2016 as compared to 2014. As a reminder, the 2014 capital program of $121 million represented a significant investment in the company's EDR Evolution program, building a completely new hosting platform of computing power and communications infrastructure at the rig site. With this updated platform now in place on the majority of the rigs we serve, we expect capital expenditures will continue to be materially lower than 2014 levels going forward, even as industry activity recovers in the future. The company recorded a net loss of $29.3 million for the first 9 months of 2016, or 35 cents per share, compared to a net loss of $13.8 million, or 16 cents per share, in the first 9 months of 2015. Turning to segmented results and starting with the U.S. business unit. The U.S. business unit posted third quarter revenue of $22.3 million, a 44% reduction from $40.2 million in the third quarter of 2015. Sequentially, revenue was $5.9 million higher than the second quarter. The year-over-year revenue decline was driven by a 39% decrease in industry activity and lower U.S. market share resulting from changes in the mix of active customers and basins. Operating income of $4.4 million was down $10.6 million from operating income of $15 million in the third quarter of 2015 and increased $4.2 million sequentially from the second quarter of 2016. Year-to-date, U.S. revenue of $62.3 million is down $73.8 million from $136.1 million in 2015. Operating income for the first 9 months of the year was of $6.2 million was $42.5 million lower than operating income of $48.7 million in 2015. Canadian business unit revenue of $10.8 million in the third quarter compared to $18.8 million in the same period of 2015, as industry activity was 38% lower year over year. Sequentially, Canadian revenue increased $5.8 million from $5 million in the second quarter as rigs returned to work following winter breakup in the second quarter. An operating profit of $735,000 was a $1.8 million decrease from an operating profit of $2.6 million in the third quarter of 2015, and up sequentially $6.1 million from an operating loss of $5.3 million in the second quarter of 2016. The Canadian business unit posted a $1.7 million operating loss in the first 9 months of 2016 on revenue of $31.6 million. This compares to a $5.3 million operating profit and $57.4 million of revenue in the first 9 months of 2015. Our third segment is the international business unit. In the third quarter, our international business unit posted revenue of $5.6 million, a 41% year-over-year decline from $9.5 million in the same quarter of 2015. Sequentially, revenue declined 4% from $5.8 million in the second quarter of 2016. The majority of our international markets have seen similarly challenging operating environments as those experienced in North America. The significant year-over-year decline was also impacted by a significant devaluation of the Argentinian peso in the fourth quarter of 2015. An operating loss of $2.3 million in the third quarter was a $2.6 million decrease from an operating profit of $311,000 in the third quarter of 2015 and included a $1.4 million charge taken in the quarter to recognize obsolete inventory. For the 9 months ended September 30, 2016, revenue for the international business unit totaled $17.7 million, down 44% from $31.7 million in the first 9 months of 2015. The 9 month comparison is similarly impacted by the devaluation of the Argentinian peso in December of 2015. An operating loss of $3.7 million in the 9 month period compared to operating income of $1.3 million in the first 9 months of 2015. Finally, I'll briefly review capital expenditures in the balance sheet. Capital expenditures in the first 9 months of 2016 totaled $12.9 million, including $1.4 million in the third quarter. This represents an 87% decrease year over year for the third quarter and a 71% decrease for the 9 month period. We expect to spend up to $20 million on capital expenditures, including capitalized R&D and IT investments, in 2016. At September 30th, we had positive working capital of $191.8 million. Our cash balance at September 30th stood at $154.6 million, down from $162 million at June 30th. There's no debt on the balance sheet, and we are maintaining our quarterly dividend at 17 cents per share. At this point, we would be happy to take any questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Greg Coleman with National Bank Financial. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. I'd like to start by talking a little bit about the competitive nature of the Canadian marketplace. Can you talk about what your Canadian market share was over the duration of the quarter from a trend perspective as opposed to just the average? Did you trend down into the end, or did you maintain sort of that 90-92% range pretty steadily over the duration of the quarter?
The market share would have been relatively consistent through the entire quarter, Greg.
Okay. And on that same note, would you be willing to provide us what your current, as in sort of today or close to today, is market share would be in Canada?
Yeah, and it would not have changed much today relative to what it would have been in the third quarter as well.
Okay. Thanks for that color, too. Moving into the U.S., but staying on market share, we expected a little bit more pressure on your U.S. market share, given the rebound in the Permian, the focus being the Permian, and my perception, at least, of your relative market share strength there. Is the resilience that we saw due more to the recently signed sort of first call agreement with the major U.S. driller, or is there some other factor at play?
Well, as you know, Greg, the southern U.S. and Texas has always been a weak spot for our market share, and that continues to be the case outside of the Permian. I think our U.S. team has focused a lot of effort, both in terms of field service and in terms of sales and account management, specifically on the Permian region. And our market share in the Permian today is, in fact, about 60%. Now, the recent win there of the large contractor relationship that you're referring to has helped a bit, but it's not really moved the needle that much yet in the Permian specifically. It's given us some uptick, but it's really been the blocking and tackling here on the ground in the Permian region of Texas.
That's great intel, actually. Thank you. Is there anything else you're doing beyond sort of what you're doing today that could take that Permian market share higher? Or is that 60%, I mean, I don't want to cap you and say that's all you're going to do, but are there any other initiatives that you're taking there we could see that rise materially, or do you think you're kind of hitting your good batting average there?
So we think there are two reasons to be optimistic about that could grow. One, it continues to be the ongoing conversion of that new contract relationship, Rick Fleet, that is by no means complete, so that will continue throughout 2017. So we expect an uptake there. And then I think it would really depend on the success of new products and services. Now, to what extent they will gain significant traction and translate into market share will depend very much on the overall mood of the industry. And whether that's early in 2017 or late, I'm sure I couldn't tell you. But I believe in the medium term, clearly there's a potential there for a further uplift in U.S. market share driven through product innovation.
Okay. On that product, thank you for that. On the product innovation, can you give us a bit of an update, and can we discuss the Schlumberger Technology Development Joint Venture? How is that progressing, and any new updates as to that agreement there and its rollout into commerciality?
So maybe I'll take a step back and talk, because I used, I think, terms the on-bottom and off-bottom roadmaps for the first time on this call, and maybe explain a bit more what's in there and what we mean by that, and then I will get to the question around the Schlumberger partnership specifically. So we have really two main product roadmaps right now. The new developments in the on-bottom roadmap includes essentially all products that affect drilling when the drill bit actually touches the rock and digs deeper. So all the products we've tried to provide there would lead to faster drilling, less wear and tear on the downhole tools or the bit, and hopefully a better, more consistent quality wellbore. So auto drillers, whether they be legacy or the new AC auto drillers, the drilling advisory system, as well as the ABLE directional advisor that you asked about, would fall into that on-bottom roadmap. The off-bottom roadmap is essentially everything else when you're not drilling. So you're tripping, you're making connections. We have had the PVT or the EPVT in here as a core product. We have recently introduced or are introducing add-ons of software features to that product, including adaptive alarms, digital trip sheets, to give you a couple of examples. There's some really smart machine learning algorithms in here that, on the one hand, improve non-productive time during that off-bottom phase of the drilling process, and obviously, more importantly, significantly increase the safety of the drilling process. So that's how we're thinking about the product roadmap at the high level without going into too much detail. So your specific question on ABLE Directional Advisor, so that's the development partnership with Schlumberger, continues to progress, now, albeit not as fast as you would have hoped 2 years ago. I think the downturn has really thrown a wrench in here in terms of product adoption and the willingness of customers to, not just for ABLE, for any new product, to try new things, to pay for new things. But it's progressing well, fundamentally, given that context. There are a significant number of wells have now been drilled with that advisor, either in shadow or in primary mode, especially in the U.S. The success has been very promising, and I think that the product pipeline here for ABLE for the winter drilling season for the next 3 to 4 months does indeed look quite promising.
Thank you, Marcel, for that. Appreciate the color. Just stepping back a minute for your contract with, or sorry, your first call agreement with the new driller, can you just remind us a little bit the first call agreement there? I believe you were on about a quarter of their fleet prior to signing it. Could you give us an indication as to what percentage of that fleet you're on now, if it is indeed growing as we had hoped?
Yes, so it will be in the 40s. As of today, essentially, there's a few rigs being converted every week, so I couldn't tell you the exact number today, but it's certainly about 40% today.
Okay,
yeah, so the starting point, summer would have been 25. As a second system that this contractor was not paying for, so the first step was essentially convert that second system to become the first system, the first 25%, that since that time would have moved 25 to over 40%.
Okay, great. I'll leave it there. I don't want to hog the time. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Greg.
Your next question comes from Ian Gillies with GMP. Please go ahead.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Ian.
With respect to the cost savings initiatives that were put in place earlier this year, I mean, are you able to provide, I guess, how far you are in realizing those cost savings in totality? Like, are you 60%? Are you 100%? Are you able to provide a bit of a gauge there just to give us a bit of an understanding?
Yeah, I would say at this point we would have realized 100% of the cost savings initiatives we would have implemented earlier in the year. And now as activity comes back, you actually see some of those variable costs, not a lot of them, but some of them would start to come back with some of the activity increase now.
And so with that point in mind, in the U.S., the incremental margins look to be close to 70%. I mean, how can you continue to enjoy that level of incremental margin until the rig count reaches 1,800? I mean, do you have a marker we can think about until you have to start add costs and maybe those incrementals start to get a bit smaller?
So, good question. It's going to be a more complicated answer. It will depend on the regional nature of the recovery. There are a number of regions where we do have significant spare capacity in terms of field techs, support resources, and there are other regions where we are actually quite tight. So it would very much depend on the regional nature of the recovery.
Okay, no, and that's fair enough. If I were to kind of think about that 70% incremental we saw in the U.S. in Q3, and we were to move over to Canada, I mean, it's a bit noisier going from Q2 to Q3, but as we go from Q3 to Q4, maybe into winter drilling season, do you think Canada is in better shape from an incremental standpoint or worse shape?
Well, from the perspective of the people cost in terms of the basin and capacity question, I think Canada is probably in okay shape there. We don't see a lot of additional cost there. One of the costs that you sort of look at, Ian, is as you start to have equipment go back to work and you sort of have repair loops fire up again, you don't necessarily want to all of a sudden ramp that too quickly versus level load your partners appropriately through a steady stream. And so what you'll start to see is that you may actually see a little bit of compression as you start to get to a level base of some of these operational expenses again, rather than sort of hold back too long and then sort of introduce a level of activity they're not prepared for.
Okay. No, that's helpful. And I wanted to, from the product standpoint, I wanted to switch back to Able, and I'm just curious as to whether it may be where it may be most attractive to customers, or if there's a specific areas where you think it's going to fit in well relative to maybe areas that it won't.
I don't think that Able really has a specific geographic footprint or focus, right? Essentially, any directional well that's being drilled can use the Able algorithm to achieve both, hopefully, a better quality, more consistent wellbore, as well as some cost savings. So I don't think the regional nature of the recovery will play into the adoption of Able.
Okay. And last one for me, there was one of your competitors recently signed a JV agreement with Saudi Aramco. And while it may just be for equipment, I'm wondering if it's perhaps changed your views, or if you have any commentary around it, how you think it may affect Pason's market position in Saudi.
Yes, so good question. I think it doesn't change our market position today. Our market share in Saudi continues to be only about 10%. I think that specific competitor lands a nice coup there. I believe it's not just equipment, it's also service delivery. And it's one of those competitors, as you may recall, that we are typically largely locked out of. So it probably limits our ultimate growth potential in Saudi Arabia. But given that we're only at 10%, I believe there is significant room for growth for us for the next few years. So I don't see any short to medium term implications there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Marcel. That's very helpful. I'll turn the call back over at this point.
Thank you.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from John Morrison with CIBC World Markets. Please go ahead.
Morning, all.
Good morning, John.
In terms of the market share slippage that you had in Canada in Q3, just as a point of clarification, do you believe that your percentage today carries forward in the coming quarters, or do you believe that as the absolute rig count rises, you believe your percentage of active EDRs will tick higher? Like, if the rig count doubles, I would assume that you would view your percentage as probably rising. Is that a fair statement?
That would certainly have been the case historically. If you look at any kind of downturn over the last 20 or 30 years, Pason has always lost market share in weak activity environments and has always recovered market share in higher activity. So I don't think we have every reason to believe that would be the case here as well.
Yeah.
I don't know whether we have a lot more insight beyond that as to how it might play out.
Okay. Given some of the market share slippage that you saw in Q3 in Canada, do you believe that the stickiness of your product offering has degraded at all in the last 3 or 6 months versus what it was over, call it, the last decade?
John, let me just be clear. We did not see slippage in market share in Canada from Q2 to Q3. That is not the case. So there would not have been any significant change based on what we know and see.
Okay. So you don't believe you lost any customers at the end of the day over the last 3 months versus 6 or 12 months ago?
Well, in any market conditions, we're always winning and losing customers. So that Canadian market share has always sort of had some amount of churn of customers in and out, and that dynamic hasn't changed in any way, shape, or form. But in terms of the overall market share picture, has not changed.
Okay. Can you talk about the competitive pressures in the U.S. and whether you believe that you might have to contemplate similar pricing moves in the lower 48 as you did in Canada to try to maintain market share go forward? Like, I recognize that your U.S. market share was fantastic in the quarter, especially considering that the Permian perhaps wasn't traditionally your strongest foothold. But I'm just wondering, what are you seeing out of your largest competitor, and does that impact how you think about pricing on a go-forward basis?
Good question, John. The situation in the U.S. has always been, we've always faced a lot more fierce competition here, which is also obviously reflected in the fact that we do have lower market share in the U.S. than in Canada. As a result, our pricing in the U.S. has always been somewhat more competitive. And I think the observation has actually been that over the course of 2016, pricing pressure in the U.S. has eased. And I don't think our teams here would have gotten a lot of asks or calls for more pricing concessions. And that's quite different in Canada. I think pricing pressure in Canada has mounted in 2016. So based on what we see today, I think we don't expect to have to make more pricing concessions in the U.S. going forward.
Okay. Marcel, just following on Ian's question, do you expect your market share in the Middle East to continue to expand over the next 6 to 12 months, including Saudi Arabia and other markets as well, just based on your current conversations to date?
Yes, we certainly do. So I think both, they're two very different businesses for us there, right? We operate in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia through a 50-50 JV. I mentioned earlier that our market share for all the rigs drilling for Saudi Aramco is about 10%. We believe that will go up over time. Now, the broader region there, we recently, at the beginning of this year, in fact, opened the business development office in Dubai. I think that's translating nicely into some new work in the region, in Gulf States, in Oman, in Kuwait, and in the broader region. So we do expect a market share uptick there going forward. Now, market share numbers are harder to come by in some of those markets, so I don't know if they're going to be able to give you more reliable numbers there. Even in the U.S. and Canada, market share is sometimes a tricky problem. But clearly, in terms of we expect to gain more rigs, there's no question.
This has obviously been a challenging 2 years for everyone in the global energy sector. As you look at your supply chain, do you get concerned at all about the health of any of your vendors in terms of hardware or other components being a major challenge to source go forward? And I guess I'm really wondering is, would you ever have to look at internalized manufacturing or anything along those lines, or you believe the capital intensity of your business remains fairly stable on a go-forward basis?
That's an excellent question, John, and I think that's something we've been trying to highlight for people through the last couple of years in terms of the CapEx remaining at the level it's remained. Part of that is to maintain the viability of the key contract manufacturing partners we have. And the business we do with those partners is both new builds and the repair of equipment as it comes back from the field and gets refreshed for further deployment. And so we're always managing that throughput of activity, combining both new build products and repair loop activity. And so we feel quite comfortable that our supply chain remains viable and we have good visibility to appropriate levels of throughput for them to manage their businesses through this. But we've clearly been working very closely with contract manufacturing partners right from actually late 2014 as we saw the downturn starting to come and pushing some of the, you know, what we had committed CapEx even back in 2014 was really pushed through 15 and 16 to allow them to level load their businesses for a long-term downturn.
And maybe to add to that, John, so we talked about the CMs here who have a significant amount of their business with Payson or with the oil field in general. John earlier talked about our investments in 2013-14 in what we call the EDR evolution, where we made significant investments in new servers, routing capabilities, and displays. The main hardware components there are, in fact, not manufactured by CMs, but by OEMs who have very limited exposure to the oil field otherwise. So they are completely resilient. They might have seen a small downtick in their business, but there is no question about the survival of those suppliers.
Perfect. John, when you think about cash deployment over the coming period, has your expectations around expensed R&D investments changed at all? I think in the last couple of quarters, you've talked about them probably being 15 to 20% below 2015 levels. Is that still a fair assumption?
Yeah, I think we would expect that we will expense more R&D in sort of the fourth quarter of 16 and into 17 than we historically might have. And that's just the mix of of R&D investments in terms of the work on existing products versus new products, what gets capitalized and doesn't. As you've scaled back the R&D organization, that proportion shifts a little bit and results in a little more expensing versus capitalization.
I apologize for harping on this point again, but I'd always say that I thought Payson has a remarkable track record for operating with strong financial discipline, and I'd call it an overwhelming pragmatism about how you operate in pretty much everything you do. And yet, you over-distributed cash flow by more than $6 million in the quarter. You have a fairly cautious outlook on a go-forward basis, and you're largely funding the dividend off the balance sheet go-forward. How do I reconcile, basically, a very pragmatic past with paying more than you're making right now on a go-forward basis?
I think the short answer is two parts. One is, we do think we have excess cash relative to the capital structure the business requires. So we do think the business should be net cash for purposes of funding, you know, potential M&A opportunities, working capital growth, and maintaining some buffer against the volatility of the industry that we operate in. But we have tremendous operating leverage as well. And so as the industry activity slowly improves, our ability to fund substantial portions of the dividend from operating cash flow materially improves.
John, is there a minimum amount of cash that you wouldn't be comfortable going below, just given your pragmatic history with running a net cash balance on the balance sheet?
Well, I can't give you a specific number, but I think somewhere in that $50 to $100 million range probably adequately covers those various areas that we've talked about in terms of, again, M&A potentially, or working capital requirements and volatility buffer.
And I think the working capital requirements can obviously be quite significant if we do actually face a significant upturn in activity.
That's right.
Appreciate the color. Good quarter to you and the team. I'll turn it back.
Thanks, John.
Thank you, John.
Your next question comes from Greg Coleman with National Bank Financial. Please go ahead.
Sorry, just want to follow up, and I also wanted to build on John's questions there. When you talk about working capital requirement in other areas of energy services, we have had issuers quantify the draw on working capital that's going to be required for every incremental dollar that bounces in revenue. Can you give us an idea as to what kind of cash is going to be needed to fund 100 million, 200 million, whatever you want to call it, 50 million, 5 million of revenue increases so we can get an idea as to the burden that's going to place on the balance sheet?
I can't give you that exact number, Greg, only because the ultimate amount of cash you require really depends on the speed at which the recovery happens in various areas. So if it's a very quick recovery, your working capital cash requirement is much higher than if it's a slower recovery. But it could be in the sort of lower tens of millions of dollars for working capital build in what we sort of see as a 2017 potential environment. But to give you a specific number, would be presuming what exactly the profile of a recovery looks like in addition to the quantum.
Okay, to rephrase it and probably put it back at you without backing you in a corner here, none of us know what 2017 is going to look like. But based on strip, based on announced capital budgets, based on the direction of the rig program, it's not unreasonable for revenue growth of anywhere from 20 to 50% to occur. And if we were to see something in that range over the course of 2017, your comment of lower tens, call that maybe $20 or $30 million of working capital requirements. Would that be reasonable?
That's very reasonable, I think, yes.
Okay, great. That was it for me. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, Greg.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. There are no further questions at this time.
In that case, we will conclude the call. Thank you very much, everybody, and have a good day.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.